Tethys, the goddess of the sea, had dropped the bars, and the horses, with a jolt, abruptly started. Cleaving with their feet the clouds, beating the air with their wings, outrunning all the winds that were rising from the same eastern quarter. Immediately, the chariot was so light without its accustomed weight, the car began to rock about like a ship tossing without ballast on the waves. The driver, panic-stricken, forgot the reins and knew nothing of the road. Wildly mounting, the team grazed the heights of the sky and startled the remotest constellations. The Great and Little Bear were scorched. The serpent lying curled about the polar stars grew warm, and with the heat grew dangerously fierce. Bootes took flight, encumbered with his plow. The scorpion struck with his tail. The chariot, having roared for some time through unknown regions of the air, knocking against the stars, next plunged down crazily to the clouds just above the ground, and the moon beheld, in amazement, her brother's horses running below her own. The clouds evaporated. The earth burst into flame. Mountains blazed. Cities perished with their walls. Nations were reduced to ashes. That was the time the peoples of Ethiopia became black, for the blood was drawn to the surface of their bodies by the heat. Libya became a desert. The Nile fled in terror to the ends of the earth and hid its head, and it is hidden yet. Mother Earth, shielding her scorched brow with her hand, choking with hot smoke, lifted her great voice and called upon Jove, the father of all things, to save his world. "Look around," she cried at him. "The heavens are asmoke from pole to pole. Great Jove, if the sea perish, and the land, and all the realms of the sky, then we are back again in the chaos of the beginning. Take thought for the safety of our universe. Save from the flames whatever yet remains." Jove, the Almighty Father, hastily summoned the gods to witness that unless some measure were quickly taken, all was lost. Thereupon he hurried to the zenith, took a thunderbolt in his right hand, and flung it from beside his ear. The car shattered. The horses, terrified, broke loose. Phaeton, fire raging in his hair, descended like a falling star. And the river Po received his burning frame. The naiads of that land consigned his body to a tomb, whereupon this epitaph:
"Here Phaeton lies, in Phoebus' car he fared, and though he greatly failed, more greatly dared."
This tale of indulgent parenthood illustrates the antique idea that when the roles of life are assumed by the improperly initiated, chaos supervenes. When the child outgrows the popular idol of the mother breast and turns to face the world of specialized adult action, it passes spiritually into the sphere of the father, who becomes, for his son, the sign of the future task, and for his daughter, of the future husband. Whether he knows it or not, and no matter what his position in society, the father is the initiating priest through whom the young being passes on into the larger world. And just as, formerly, the mother represented the good and evil, so now does he. But with this complication, that there is a new element of rivalry in the picture, the son against the father for the mastery of the universe, and the daughter against the mother to be the mastered world. The traditional idea of initiation combines an introduction of the candidate into the techniques, duties, and prerogatives of his vocation with a radical readjustment of his emotional relationship to the parental images. The mystagogue, father or father substitute, is to entrust the symbols of office only to a son who has been effectually purged of all inappropriate infantile cathexes, for whom the just, impersonal exercise of the powers will not be rendered impossible by unconscious, or perhaps even conscious and rationalized, motives of self-aggrandizement, personal preference, or resentment. Ideally, the invested one has been divested of his mere humanity, and is representative of an impersonal cosmic force. He is the twice-born. He has become himself the father, and he is competent, consequentially, now to enact himself the role of the initiator, the guide, the sun-door, through whom one may pass from the infantile illusions of good and evil to an experience of the majesty of cosmic law, purged of hope and fear, and at peace in the understanding of the revelation of being. "Once I dreamed," declared a little boy, "that I was captured by cannonballs. They all began to jump and yell. I was surprised to see myself in my own parlor. There was a fire, and a kettle was over it full of boiling water. They threw me into it, and once in a while the cook used to come over and stick a fork into me to see if I was cooked. Then he took me out and gave me to the chief, who was just going to bite me when I woke up," a civilized gentleman states.
"I dreamed that I was at table with my wife. During the course of the meal, I reached over and took our second child, a baby, and in a matter-of-fact fashion proceeded to put him into a green soup bowl, full of hot water or some hot liquid, for he came out cooked thoroughly, like chicken fricassee. I laid the viand on a breadboard at the table and cut it up with my knife. When we had eaten all of it except a small part, like a chicken gizzard, I looked up, worried, to my wife, and asked her, 'Are you sure you wanted me to do this? Did you intend to have him for supper?' She answered, with a domestic frown, 'After he was so well cooked, there was nothing else to do.' I was just about to finish the last piece when I woke up."
This archetypal nightmare of the ogre father is made actual in the ordeals of primitive initiation. The boys of the Australian Murnjin tribe, as we have seen, are first frightened and sent running to their mothers. The great father snake is calling for their foreskins. This places the women in the role of protectresses. A prodigious horn is blown, named Yurlungur, which is supposed to be the call of the great father snake, who has emerged from his hole. When the men come for the boys, the women grab up spears and pretend not only to fight, but also to wail and cry, because the little fellows are going to be taken away and eaten. The men's triangular dancing ground is the body of the great father snake. There the boys are shown, during many nights, numerous dances symbolical of the various totem ancestors, and are taught the myths that explain the existing order of the world. Also, they are sent on a long journey to neighboring and distant clans, imitative of the mythological wanderings of the phallic ancestors. In this way, within the great father snake, as it were, they are introduced to an interesting new object world that compensates them for their loss of the mother, and the male phallus, instead of the female breast, is made the central point, axis mundi of the imagination. The culminating instruction of the long series of rites is the release of the boy's own hero penis from the protection of its foreskin, through the frightening and painful attack upon it of the circumciser.
The father, i.e. circumciser, is the one who separates the child from the mother, writes Dr. Roheim. What is cut off the boy is really the mother. The glands in the foreskin is the child in the mother. It is interesting to note the continuance to this day of the rite of circumcision in the Hebrew and Mohammedan cults, where the feminine element has been scrupulously purged from the official, strictly monotheistic mythology. God forgiveth not the sin of joining other gods with him, we read in the Quran. The pagans, leaving Allah, call but upon female deities.
Among the Arunta, for example, the sound of the bull roarers is heard from all sides when the moment has arrived for this decisive break from the past. It is night, and in the weird light of the fire suddenly appear the circumciser and his assistant. The noise of the bull roarers is the voice of the great demon of the ceremony, and the pair of operators are its apparition. With their beards thrust into their mouths, signifying anger, their legs widely extended, and their arms stretched forward, the two men stand perfectly still, the actual operator in front, holding in his right hand the small flint knife with which the operation is to be conducted, and his assistant pressing close up behind him, so that the two bodies are in contact with each other. Then a man approaches through the firelight, balancing a shield on his head, and at the same time snapping the thumb and first finger of each hand. The bull roarers are making a tremendous din, which can be heard by the women and children in their distant camp. The man with the shield on his head goes down on one knee, just a little in front of the operator, and immediately one of the boys is lifted from the ground by a number of his uncles, who carry him feet foremost and place him on the shield, while in deep, loud tones, a chant is thundered forth by all the men. The operation is swiftly performed, the fearsome figures retire immediately from the lighted area, and the boy, in a more or less dazed condition, is attended to and congratulated by the men to whose estate he has now just arrived. "You have done well," they say. "You did not cry out." The native Australian mythologies teach that the first initiation rites were carried out in such a way that all the young men were killed. The ritual is thus shown to be, among other things, a dramatized expression of the Oedipal aggression of the elder generation, and the circumcision a mitigated castration. But the rites provide also for the cannibal, patricidal impulse of the younger, rising group of males, and at the same time reveal the benign, self-giving aspect of the archetypal father. For during the long period of symbolical instruction, there is a time when the initiates are forced to live only on the fresh drawn blood of the older men. We are told,
"The natives are particularly interested in the Christian communion rite, and having heard about it from missionaries, they compare it to the blood-drinking rituals of their own. In the evening, the men come and take their places according to tribal precedence, the boy lying with his head on his father's thighs. He must make no movement, or he will die. The father blindfolds him with his hands, because if the boy should witness the following proceedings, it is believed that his father and mother will both die. The wooden vessel, or a bark vessel, is placed near one of the boy's mother's brothers, who, having tied his arm lightly, pierces the upper part with a nose bone, and holds the arm over the vessel until a certain amount of blood has been taken. The man next to him pierces his arm, and so on, until the vessel is filled. It may hold 2 quarts or so. The boy takes a long draught of the blood. Should his stomach rebel, the father holds his throat to prevent his ejecting the blood, because if it happens, his father, mother, sisters, and brothers would all die. The remainder of the blood is thrown over him. From this time on, sometimes for a whole moon, the boy is allowed no other food than human blood, Yaminga, the mythical ancestor, having made this law. Sometimes the blood is dried in the vessel, and then the guardian cuts it in sections with his nose bone, and it is eaten by the boy, the 2 end sections first. The sections must be regularly divided, or the boy will die."
Frequently, the men who give their blood faint and remain in a state of coma for an hour or more because of exhaustion. In former times, writes another observer, this blood, drunk ceremonially by the novices, was obtained from a man who was killed for the purpose, and portions of his body were eaten. Here, comments Dr. Roheim, we come as near to a ritual representation of the killing and eating of the primal father as we can ever get.
In one recorded case, two of the boys looked up when they were not supposed to. Then the old men went forward, each with a stone knife in hand. Stooping over the two boys, they opened veins in each. Out flowed the blood, and the other men all raised a death cry. The boys were lifeless. The old Wirinuns, medicine men, dipping their stone knives in the blood, touched with them the lips of all present. The bodies of the Bura victims were cooked. Each man who had been to five Buras ate a piece of this flesh. No others were allowed to see this done.
There can be no doubt that no matter how unilluminated the stark naked Australian savages may seem to us, their symbolical ceremonials represent a survival into modern times of an incredibly old system of spiritual instruction, the far-flung evidences of which are to be found not only in all the lands and islands bordering the Indian Ocean, but also among the remains of the archaic centers of what we tend to regard as our own very special brand of civilization. Just how much the old men know, it is difficult to judge from the published accounts of our Occidental observers. But it can be seen from a comparison of the figures of Australian ritual with those familiar to us from higher cultures, that the great themes, the ageless archetypes and their operation upon the soul, remain the same.
For an astounding revelation of the survival in contemporary Melanesia of a symbolic system essentially identical with that of the Egypto-Babylonian, Trojan-Cretan labyrinth complex of the second millennium BC, see John Layard's Stone Men of Malekula. W.F.J. Knight has discussed the evident relationship of the Malekulan journey of the soul to the underworld with the classical descent of Aeneas and the Babylonian of Gilgamesh, while W.J. Perry thought he could recognize evidences of this culture continuity running all the way from Egypt and Sumer out through the oceanic area to North America.